John Hockenberry here. Thank you for downloading this podcast from WNYC and Public Radio International. You're a very discriminating person, I can tell that. Remember, we're as keen to hear from you as we are from John in Dallas or Joan in Eugene. You can follow us on Twitter at The Takeaway and find out more at thetakeaway.org. Here then, for your listening pleasure, is The Takeaway Podcast.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, in for John Hockenberry. Thank you so much for listening. We begin right away this hour with the escalating humanitarian crisis in Gaza as fighting continues between Hamas militants and Israel. We bring two voices and two perspectives now. First, a conversation I had earlier with one woman who was born and raised in a refugee camp in Gaza. Today, Gada Agil is visiting professor of political science at the University of Alberta in Canada. But before she had the opportunity to study and leave the region, her home was in the communist refugee camp in Gaza. She's a third-generation Palestinian refugee. Whether you find yourself agreeing or disagreeing with her politics, Professor Agil described what her life was like growing up in Gaza in what was a very emotional and heated conversation.
Part of my life, actually many, many years, I have been not able to leave the home. When I was 17 years old, it was, 1988 when the first intifada erupted. So there has been curfews for 6 years. I could not attend university when I was 18 because Israel closed all the universities in the Gaza Strip. The beach, which is like half kilometer from my home in Khan Yunis refugee camp, for 5-6 years in a row, we could not visit the beach. So when I was a mother, I could not nurse or breastfeed my son because if I live in the camp and I work in the city and there is curfew and there is a checkpoint that has been closed by Israel, then I cannot return. So for 4 or 5 days, I am in the city and my son in the camp when he was, around 1 year. So occupation controls all your life when you are in Gaza, be it in the town or the refugee camp. Your dreams, your plans, everything.
You mentioned the current blockade, both land and sea, and this has been a major issue in the current conflict. We've heard from lots of not only political analysts, but people in Gaza, that many of your fellow Gazans actually support the conflict going on longer if it means the blockade can be ended. Not that they like the violence, of course not, but that they want results to end the blockade. Can you explain that point of view, what the blockade means and why people, ordinary people, would be able to go to such lengths see it ended?
Yeah, I mean, we want freedom. We want dignity. We want this blockade to end. And now, my brother is a doctor. Patients come, but there is no medication. My neighbors at the moment, they are sharing the blood pressure pills and diabetes because it's running low. My sister now is hosting 2 or 3 families in her home with no water, with no electricity, with no safety. So this blockade has been very long. It's time to end it. And this is basically a humanitarian right. Now, Palestinians, they are not asking the impossible. They are asking to let people live normal life.
As Gazans strive for a normal life, one has to ask. Gazans' representative in this conflict for many years has been Hamas, and Hamas has had a policy of confrontation with Israel. Regardless of who has started each individual flare-up in the conflict, which is sort of incidental at this point, has Hamas's strategy of confrontation and rockets worked? They've led Gazans for all of these years. The point is, no results, no change in the conditions there.
But Hamas just came to the picture 7 or 8 years ago. Was the Gaza Strip in better situation before these 8 years? As I told you, I was born in the 70s. I've never witnessed or lived a calm day in Gaza. So just to put the conflict and the pretext of Hamas, before there has been Arafat and the PA, they are terrorists. Before that, it has been the PLO. Before that, it has been the Popular Front. I think Israel has to open its eyes. It's not about the leadership of Hamas. It's about a nation that has been subjected and oppressed and occupied for 66 years now. It's time to end this occupation. End of the story. I mean, when leadership are elected by people and they win the majority, then they are their representatives.
Is Hamas representing the interests of real people like your family who live there?
I think the issue, again, is not about Hamas. It's about...
But that is the question. That is the question. Do they represent the interests of real people who live in Gaza and are struggling?
I think to put it on a Hamas, it's a misleading. I am a Palestinian that has been grown, raised, lived all my life in Gaza under different administrations, the Israeli ones, the PLO, the PNA, Palestinian National Authority, and then finally Hamas. These are the leadership of the Palestinian people who represent their aspiration, which are, again, it is freedom, dignity, ending the occupation. Very basic demands. We have to deal with it. Otherwise, we would always put a pretext. They are terrorists. It is Hamas. It is the rockets. It's the self-defense of Israel. What about the Palestinians? Aren't they allowed to defend themselves? Right, states has, you know, right to defend their civilians. But what about the people under occupation?
Professor Aguil, but before we let you go, what is your hope for your family in Gaza? And I mean the way that they are living, quite apart from the conflict that the world is watching. Maybe it's impossible to separate, but what is your realistic hope?
First of all, lifting the blockade of Gaza. I mean, if you speak specifically about my family, so that they could live normal life. They could have water. They don't have water now. They could have some electricity. They could have some hope. They could have some, you know, control over their lives and their lands and their hope. For my grandmother now, she's 89 years old. This is her wish, that she could die in a dignified way. She just asked my uncle 2 weeks ago that if she, in the case of her death, to dig a hole under the mulberry tree and bury her, because it's not safe to go to the cemetery. So for my grandmother, I wish dignity. And in the next year, I hope for all Gazans to enjoy normal life by ending this illegal, inhumane blockade.
Professor Gada Aguil is visiting professor of political science at the University of Alberta, born in Gaza, longtime resident of Gaza, currently in Canada. Professor, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Of course, the great majority of Israelis have a very different perspective on this conflict. As the world watches the operation in Gaza continue, Israelis stand firmly behind their Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his country's defense forces. One recent poll finds that more than 90% of Jewish Israelis believe that Operation Protective Edge is justified. And while some in the international community have called for a ceasefire, Arab leaders have remained mostly silent, leaving Hamas isolated in the region. Joining us now in the studio is Ambassador Ido Aharoni, Consul General for Israel in New York. Mr. Ambassador, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Mr. Ambassador, if Israel's strategy in the current conflict is to demilitarize Gaza and get rid of the threat of the tunnels, which is the stated strategy, why are artillery shells falling on UN facilities, schools, and hospitals? Why do we keep hearing these reports?
Well, we don't target civilian facilities as a rule. What we do, we try to respond to the source of fire. We're not clear what exactly happened yesterday at this point, and we will look into it. We'll get to the bottom of it. But as a rule, the stated goal of this operation is to destroy the Hamas terrorist infrastructure.
At the same time, the United Nations has stated clearly that they have informed the IDF and the Israeli government about the exact coordinates of their facilities that you know. Where every single UN facility is, why are they getting hit?
You're looking at a war situation. This is not a walk in the park. A war is ugly. War is messy. I'm not familiar, and I say this as someone who experienced combat. I'm not familiar with a sterile war, with a clean war, with war with no casualties. Unfortunately, Hamas is putting its own people in harm's way because they believe that the kind of questions that you're asking me now will put international pressure on Israel. But the fact is that we know what we're up against. We're up against an organization that has a deadly and brutal ideology. They want to kill us. There is no other way to look at it. Hamas is interested in the destruction of the state of Israel.
But they're not able to really achieve it. They can inflict some pain, it's true. But people see, Hamas rockets. Nobody thinks that Israel should accept rockets raining down on its country, but they see the effectiveness of Iron Dome, and then they see the response, which is completely disproportional in many people's view. So even though Hamas is devoted to your destruction, the disproportionality here that is ongoing is something that a lot of people really can't justify in their minds.
Again, you are looking at a war situation. Our enemy has a well-defined territorial unit they're operating from. Hamas has been controlling Gaza since early 2007. Instead of turning it into a thriving community, they decided to turn it into one big ammunition depot. We need to take care of that problem. No society, no country will ever accept 3,000 missiles. These are not fireworks. We have to understand. These missiles can destroy an entire building. One missile can destroy an entire building. So this is something that no government in the world should accept, and Israel is no different.
What makes you think, once your stated goal is achieved, demilitarizing Gaza, at least to some extent, degrading Hamas's ability to strike you, and destroying the militarized tunnels that are threatening Israel, once these things are achieved, what makes you think that we won't be back having this exact same conversation in another two and a half years? Of course, we both know we've had this conversation before, not you and I, but this conversation happens every couple years. You can achieve a military objective here. We're going to be back in the same place in another 18 months or 2 years.
Right, right. This is certainly a possibility. And of course, your question only strengthened the argument. And in fact, what we're looking at is yet another bloody chapter of a century-old Arab's onslaught on Jewish national sovereignty in the land of Israel. This conflict did not start yesterday. And by the way, it's important for our listeners to understand the conflict that we have with Hamas is not territorial. This is not about ending the so-called occupation. Hamas was given Gaza in 2005, and look what they did with it. This is not a territorial conflict. This is an ideological, inter-civilizational clash. And so, therefore, we have to understand to look at it yet at another bloody chapter of the battle between the free world and radical Islamism. This is what you're looking at. This is not a territorial dispute between Israel and Palestine.
Mr. Ambassador, that's all true what you just said about the long arc of the conflict. At the same time, every single Palestinian citizen that we've had on this program in the last week has expressed here and now their need to have the blockade lifted, that they're suffocating, they can't get water, they have no power, they can't feed their infants, there's no formula. Real humanitarian crises right now. What will it take, even in the next couple of days, to get supplies to some starving Palestinians and to lift the blockade that is really choking that area?
Well, there are three elements to my answer. The first is, why do we have those restrictions? Why were they put in? They were put in because of the fact that Hamas was constantly trying to amass more ammunition and rockets and missiles to attack Israel. Secondly, even during this military operation, and we're at the 24th day of this operation, the border crossing between Israel and Gaza is open, has been open. 100 trucks per day on average go in with supplies to the people of Gaza. And lastly, the most important thing, we accepted 5 proposals for ceasefire, 3 of them for humanitarian ceasefire called by the United Nations. While we accepted them and actually abide by them, it was Hamas that kept on shelling rockets and firing missiles. So I think all the evidence show that Hamas is putting its own people in harm's way deliberately. It's part of their ideology. It's a deadly, brutal ideology, and the people of Gaza are the first to suffer. Hamas is all about the past. They're not about the future. They're offering nothing but darkness to their own people, and we have to realize that.
Ambassador Ido Aharoni is the Consul General for Israel in New York. Mr. Ambassador, thank you for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Just when you thought it was safe to go back on the Twitter.
Admit it, you're only watching Sharknado to tweet about it and get lots of retweets.
Finn. Ah! Shark. Ah! Finn. Ah! Shark. Ah! Submitted for your Emmy consideration.
Still better than Lucy.
I want to put bears in a monsoon. Who wants to fund my movie project?
Buzzsaw hand Tara Reid is peak humanity. Hashtag Sharknado 2.
The takeaway players there with some dramatic readings of some of the best Sharknado 2 tweets from last night. Sharknado 2, the second one, hit those small screens last night. The much-anticipated sequel to one of the most tweeted films of all time. With me at the center of the storm on the next installment of the sci-fi made-for-TV cult classic, is Kristen Meinzer, who watched the film and the Twitter sphere last night. Kristen is culture producer for The Takeaway and co-host of the Movie Date podcast. Hi, Kristen.
Hi, Todd.
Let me say off the top that we just heard the tweets there of Emily Nussbaum, Ethan Clapper, Elahi Azadi, Pani Wazik, one or two others. Great tweets from last night. I got to tell you, I didn't get sci-fi in my hotel room here in New York. I watched Sharknado 2 on Twitter. I feel like I didn't miss a thing.
You know what? I'm going to recommend you still find a way to watch this movie because it's one of the greatest movie events of all time. And yes, the Twitter, like the whole time you're watching the movie, you just want to tweet the whole time because it's hard not to. It's the lines are spectacular. All the cameos are amazing. Like you wouldn't believe the people who show up in this movie. And it's all tongue in cheek. You have Judd Hirsch from Taxi playing a taxi driver. You have Robert Hayes, who played Ted Stryker in Airplane, playing an airplane pilot. You have Billy Ray Cyrus playing a doctor, Kelly Osbourne, and all these people, of course, it seems like in the contract, it seems that if you got to be in this movie, you also get to be eaten by a shark.
Where did we get to the point where pretty much everybody in Hollywood wants to be part of this, or at least people with B-movie cred?
How do you not want to be in Sharknado 2? You make it sound like it's even a question. Everybody wants to be in Sharknado 2. This is, you get to utter lines like, this is one of my favorites. I know you're scared. I'm scared too, because they're sharks. And sharks are scary. No, how can you top that? That's Ian Ziering, who plays the lead, Finn Shepard, in this movie.
Finn Shepard, yes. Ian Ziering of 90210 fame, I guess you could call it.
That is right. That's him rallying the troops, getting people ready to fight the Sharknado. How can you beat those kinds of lines?
Now, Kristen Meinzer, how did we get to the point, though, as amazing as this movie is, where a movie, two movies about tornadoes made of sharks terrorizing U.S. cities on planes and everywhere else became cultural media phenomena that everybody just wanted to be a part of, at least on the internet, if not on television.
How ridiculous is it? Can you think of a more ridiculous thing than a Sharknado? And it's fun to just say Sharknado. Like, you don't even have to explain. These are tornadoes filled with sharks. And you can just say Sharknado over and over again, and you'll kind of giggle to yourself every time.
Is it about, you think, is it about the sarcasm of how stupid the movie is? Is it so bad that it's good? It feels a little bit Rocky Horror-ish to me, which is one of my favorite things of all time.
Oh, I think it's deliberately awful, and everyone's really just enjoying themselves who's watching it and who's in the movies. I love the conviction that the actors bring to their roles. When Ian Ziering is fighting those sharks in those Sharknados with those chainsaws, you see the look on his face like, I'm going to kill you, mother sharks. I'm going to kill you.
So what's next? There's no way we're getting out of this without Sharknado 3, right? It's just it's doing too well.
There have been hints that there is going to be a Sharknado 3, and I hope that those hints aren't just teases. I hope that it's genuine, it's real. And if we're really lucky, maybe we'll even get a theatrical release. The first Sharknado did get a theatrical release abroad. Keeping my fingers crossed, Sharknado 2 and maybe Sharknado 3 will see in the theaters as well.
Kristen Meinzer is not content with Sharknado on the small TV screen. She wants to see it on the silver screen, because that's what she's all about. Kristen Meinzer, cultural producer at The Takeaway and co-host of the Movie Date podcast. Before we go, let me bring you up to speed on the best Sharknado tweet from last night. Hands down, came from Pour Me Coffee, the Twitter legend. As the action in Sharknado rages, he says, Barack Obama, are you even in the Situation Room? In just a few minutes, we're going to have a conversation with our partner, The New York Times, about their recent decision to come out in support of legalizing marijuana. But first, there is some tension playing out across the country between states that have legalized recreational marijuana, and there are two of them right now, and the jurisdictions that border on those states who don't want marijuana legalized. For Nebraska, which is right up against Colorado, the substance is making its way across the border. Towns in Nebraska are reporting dramatic increases in marijuana-related crimes, and they are not happy about it. BJ Wilkinson is the chief of police for the Sidney, Nebraska Police Department, which borders right on Colorado. Chief, welcome.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Thanks for being on. Tell us how your life as chief has changed in these several many months since Colorado legalized marijuana.
In the first 5 months of 2014, we arrested as many people for marijuana-related crimes as we did in all of 2013. That has an impact not only on us in terms of calls for service and the workload that goes with that, but it also has an impact on our jail, which is run by our sheriff's office. And then that trickles into the judicial process. The amount of work that's being pushed through the entire process is at times and can be overwhelming.
Now, of course, we all know, Chief, that a crime is what the law says it is. So you're seeing an increase in marijuana-related crimes for things that just a mile or two away are legal, like possession of a couple of grams of marijuana. Folks in Colorado might say, well, you're having trouble in your jail and you're having trouble in your courts because you're criminalizing something that should be legal.
Yeah, you're exactly right. I mean, that's the rub. There are people that leave Nebraska, go across the border to take a 15-minute drive. They could go and purchase marijuana and marijuana-related products. And there's some sense of entitlement. You're exactly right about that. That, hey, guess what? I bought it legally. I possessed it legally. I should be able to bring it home legally. And Nebraska law doesn't say that. Nebraska law says it is illegal to possess any amount. I'm not in favor of the legalization of marijuana because I, having been a police officer both in Wyoming and Illinois and now in Nebraska for almost a quarter of a century, I've seen the effects, the long-term and the short-term effects of marijuana use on a community, on families, on quality of life issues.
What are some of those effects that you feel like you've seen, the detrimental effects on people and families?
Lots of experience with families who have been involved in the regular recreational use of marijuana, which often typically turns into a lifestyle that centers around the way to get some marijuana, disposable income or critical income in family units oftentimes becomes displaced. And rather than we're paying for the things that we need to keep the family unit running, the family finances revolve around how to carve out enough money to get the next bag of weed because we like to use it, we like to smoke it.
But that's not necessarily a crime. People generally don't do B&Es, breaking and entering, to get marijuana. I mean, maybe they do, but generally not.
Well, typically not. And you're right about that. But we start to see the impact of the displacement of financial priority from one area to another, then begin to impact our ability to maintain things like rent and utilities. We start to see the ability diminish to get to work on time and maintain gainful employment. We start to see the foundations of a family deteriorate through the regular, habitual, and what people like to call recreational use of marijuana.
Even if all those even if all those things are true, and I'm sure that you're probably right in a lot of cases, are those things the concern of a law enforcement officer like yourself?
Yeah, they do, because they oftentimes lead to other issues. Property crime, we see a rise in methamphetamine use. We see an increase in the amount of prescription medication on the black market. And now we're starting to see an increase in the availability of heroin, all on the wave that marijuana use has created as it comes across a border from a state that's legal to us.
Chief, before we let you go, I know maybe this isn't realistic, but do you wish you could have your officers kind of set up a roadblock over there on a border and stop everyone coming through and kind of deal with this problem that way?
I'd love to be able to set up a wall, but quite frankly, it's coming to us faster than we could stop it.
Marijuana is now legal in Colorado, and just a couple miles away, one police chief says it's spilling over into his community in ways that they don't want. BJ Wilkinson is chief of police in Sidney, Nebraska. Hey, Chief, thanks.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Well, we just heard one view of a police chief who thinks marijuana needs to stay illegal, but the editorial board at our partner, the New York Times, started making their argument just this past week that it's high time, those are their words, to make marijuana legal across the country. This might come as a surprise to some of you who are familiar with a certain op-ed piece written not so long ago by Times columnist Maureen Dowd, where she chronicled her experience trying a pot candy bar in Denver. And once that marijuana reached her bloodstream, Dowd writes, "I became convinced that I had died and no one was going to tell me." The experience led Dowd to conclude that in the hands of a novice like herself, marijuana can have frightening effects. But in spite of that testimony, the Times editorial team says that considering questions of public health and the prison rate in this country, the economic consequences and more, marijuana must and should be legalized, at least at the federal level. I had a discussion with Andrew Rosenthal about why the paper took this stance. Andy is the editorial page editor at the New York Times. It's his department that's behind the series.
The federal government needs to get out of two businesses. One is the business of prosecuting people for marijuana possession and use. And the other one is they need to get out of the business of propagandizing against marijuana. The Office of National Drug Control Policy issued a statement disagreeing with our editorials, although not really, and it was kind of tepid. But you have to remember that they're required by law to do that. There is a law that requires that organization to oppose all legalization efforts. That law needs to be gotten rid of as well. And the propagandizing about marijuana at the national level just has to stop. And it has to be dealt with at the community level. I mean, people will tell you that there's no, you know, the law says that marijuana is classified as the highest possible narcotic because it has no known medical application. That's just absolutely false. And there's a lot in the federal law and in the conduct of the government that needs to change, and then it will happen at the community level. I think we'll find states reacting differently from place to place depending on their values, just as you do now. We now have 37 states that allow the consumption of THC in some form in straightforward violation of federal law. And that's just not a tenable situation for us. So I think it will take time. I don't think marijuana is ever going to become mainstream culture. I think it has this kind of, you know, Mr. Natural, hippy-dippy thing associated with it. But that's fine, too. We're not advocating that everybody go out and smoke marijuana. We're just, you know, saying that the balance of the law needs to change.
Maybe in 10 years, Maureen Dowd's next column will be going to Atlanta, Georgia, and trying out some legal marijuana there.
That column caused quite a stir. You know, I would just say that, you know, it was interesting, and she had her experience, and I'm not, you know, sort of talking about that, but, you know, she wrote two columns from Colorado, and they were very important. They were about a very important subject that Colorado was actually grappling with, and that's about labeling of edibles. Edibles are particularly hazardous because it's very hard to know how much you're consuming. The effect is delayed. And I remember at least the, you know, the urban legend when, you know, when we were younger, or at least when I was younger, was that when you cook marijuana, it becomes more potent. And I think that's true. So the labeling and the consistency and those issues have to be dealt with. And I think it's great that Colorado is trying to do this. And you have to give some credit to the governor, John Hickenlooper, because he opposed legalization. But he has thrown himself into making it happen in a good way, and it's just been incredible to watch. And I know that there's some legislation or regulations moving in Colorado now about readjusting labeling, and the industry of marijuana production is going to have to accept labeling. I understand it's counterculture and they don't like labels, but they have to. You know, every plant that is grown for sale in Colorado has to have an RFID tag on it. Every time they cut a shoot off to then clone it in another bucket, they have to put an RFID tag on it. And the people who did this said that setting that up was complicated, but once it's set up, it just becomes part of the workflow and it's no big deal. Those kinds of things have to happen. And the idea that that can be done in Washington is crazy. You know, I'm not a total states' rights person. There are things the federal government should do, but it can't happen in Washington. And with this Congress, which is incapable of passing an intelligent law about anything, the idea that they're going to be the ones to regulate it, it's unthinkable to me.
Andy Rosenthal, I know you're not necessarily here to talk about Maureen Dowd, but you were right that her column did create quite a stir. One of the issues that it raised was a lot of people saying you used it wrong, meaning there has to be a lot more education about how marijuana, edibles in this case, are properly used. You know, drinking five shots of alcohol is not the same as drinking five glasses of wine over a night. And this was sort of the same thing. And it makes me wonder if in a couple of years you see in America where people don't make mistakes like Maureen Dowd made in her hotel room, that they have sort of a different approach.
I think so. I mean, I think it's education and the labeling issues I was just talking about. And I think Maureen's point was that she did it wrong and the result was bad because she talked about, as I said, the substantive issue of labeling. And I think education is necessary. The fact is that, you know, for the 80 years since Prohibition was lifted and people – we've been having educational programs about alcohol, people still drink those five shots. And, you know, one of the things that everybody has to bear in mind, and I've given this lecture to my children, is that when you consume this stuff, it lowers your inhibitions and leads you to think that having more is okay. So we all have to do that. And I think as parents, the obligation on us is enormous. And, you know, abdicating it to government is not going to work. But, yes, I agree with you that people will have to understand. And I think that, you know, that over time, too, there's a thing that happens now in this in the ganjapreneur business, as they call themselves, which is going for maximum potency, you know, and because that's part of the culture. that's going to have to fade a little bit, you know, just as we've got light beer, the purpose of which I don't understand, but, you know, we have to have weak pot, you know what I mean? It's not everything has to be maximum potency. And I think that'll happen as it becomes more mainstream. And, you know, towns, we have a video that we did for nytimes.com that's running this Sunday about the towns of Crested Butte and Gunnison, which are small towns in southwestern Colorado, one of which allows sale and one of which doesn't. And it's fascinating to watch the interplay of the people in those towns. But that's the way it should be happening. Local people deciding for themselves.
Andy Rosenthal is editorial page editor of the New York Times. The New York Times has just this week called for an end to marijuana prohibition, and they have a whole series of editorials on the way on different aspects of marijuana prohibition. Andy, thank you for joining us.
It was a real pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
Most, 99.9% of the information you get about Africa is wrong.
Political firebrand, musical innovator, Nigerian folk hero, rebel, global icon, Fela Kuti was a figure eminently of his time and also someone who was entirely ahead of his time. His time in the U.S. profoundly influenced his musical sensibility and inspired him to begin the experimentation that would eventually lead to the creation of Afrobeat. The story of Fela Kuti's journey as a creative and ideological leader is the subject of director Alex Gibney's new documentary, Finding Fela, which opens in selected theaters across the country in August. Femi Kuti, world-renowned and Grammy-nominated musician and son of Fela Kuti, sat down with me to talk about his father's life and legacy.
He had a lot of influence from his mother coming to America, meeting the Black Panthers, reading books on African history, going back to Nigeria and not understanding why African leaders were not doing enough to promote putting good infrastructures in place and why the leaders were so corrupt. And he tried to use his music to fight against this.
When you are a revolutionary and you talk the truth, people will come and slap you down. Then you talk the truth again, they lock you in jail. Then when you are very strong and you talk again, they may kill you. They may even burn your house down, like they burnt my house down at home. Now, they come and tell you not to say the truth again. Then I tell them and say they will hear more until they can hear no more, because the truth can never die.
And so that a Fela Kuti concert, Femi Kuti, was part political polemic, all music, of course, and then a mixture of the two.
The political part was very essential in the music all the time. He couldn't understand the love songs in Africa with so much poverty and suffering. Right now, as we speak, the doctors in Nigeria are on strike. So many poor people are dying. What love song is more important than talking about this issue? You talk about the terrorist attack in Nigeria, the missing girls. The kind of upbringing my father had, which he gave me, is... he put the suffering of people before his personal matters, so to say.
Fela Kuti had a club, of course, in Lagos. He called it The Shrine, correct?
Yes.
Where I learned that every night was a different night. Of course, Ladies' Night was Tuesday.
Yeah.
Naturally.
Oh, you've done a lot of research, yes. Tuesday. Friday night was the Yabis night, which was he used Friday to kind of abuse the government.
Well, let's hear a little bit about what Yabis night, Friday nights, was like at The Shrine.
What is happening in Nigerian prisons is nothing short of Nazism. I saw it with my eyes. They were flogging boys, 8 in the morning, 24 strokes. They put sand on the body before they flogged them. And this is not from court order. This is just warder's enjoyment.
Was there a worry for his survival? He was highly critical,
yes,
of powerful people. He called them out individually.
Yes.
He called them names. People who don't mess around and people who have a lot to lose.
Yes.
Revolutionary, yes, brave maybe, but also stupid.
I don't know if he personally feared for his life. Well, he never showed that to anybody. But definitely everybody around him, including his kids, us, my mother, we were always afraid that he would get killed. And everybody spoke to him, but he always shrugged it off his shoulder, said that's not going to stop him from speaking the truth. probably had a death wish as well, because he did things that we never understood why. He always provoked the authorities. I mean, like calling their names. Everybody knew if you call their names, they were going to come and retaliate.
So he was an angry person, though. He was angry about the death of his mother.
I don't think he was angry. It's not. I don't know if you can call it anger. It is more of probably upset. Nigeria had money. Why weren't they not giving Africa good education? Why were they not building good roads, healthcare service? What he was talking about then in the 70s, Nigeria is still facing critical issues on these topics. So I think he was just crying out loud all the time, saying, we need to get things straight.
There's plenty to talk about with politics and with revolution with Fela Kuti. But while you're here, we have to talk a little bit about music, or else we will have missed an opportunity. Many Americans will not have heard of high life music, but when they hear it, they say, oh yeah, that sounds familiar, because it has influenced so many things that we hear here in the United States. Can you describe a little bit about what high life music was, how it interacted with American funk? People know James Brown, and Fela's music and James Brown have something in common.
High life music, I think, is really from the Caribbean somewhere. I'm not very sure. But the Ghanaians were the ones like in the forefront in Africa playing high life music. And my father loved the way the Ghanaians played high life music. His mother called him and told him if he wanted to be successful as a musician, he had to form his own kind of music. And this was how the Afrobeat started. And James Brown was very big. And I think my father just saw James Brown as, should I use the word oppressive? Oppressive in the sense that, not negatively, that it was, he had to come up with something better than James Brown.
Oppressive creatively, in other words, artistically.
Yes. This was the challenge of the beginning of his career. He had to come up with something his people would love him for, and this was the Afrobeat.
I'd like to talk a bit, if I can, about your father's death, if I may.
Yes, of course.
From AIDS, like so many tens of millions. He was a person in life who denied that HIV could cause AIDS, or that AIDS was dangerous. And I wonder what you feel that came from. Was it a sense of arrogance? Was it a sense of personal power that he couldn't be conquered?
You have to understand the effect of colonialism on people like my father. If Europe talks about AIDS or AIDS is killing Africa, people like him will have to fight back. And there was not enough proof at this time of my father's era that AIDS was caused by sex. And I think the way AIDS was marketed, the propaganda against AIDS started, was not well put together by the UN. Because even when my father's brother was warning my father, I remember this story very clearly, that there's AIDS. My father said, show me one AIDS patient. So they always had this argument.
What do you think his political legacy has been? Was he able, through his music and through his club and through his preachments from the stage, to affect the politics or the social situation of Nigeria in a positive way? Did people really learn from him?
Definitely. If Nigerians are outspoken today, this is because of my father. Because you have to remember, throughout the 70s and part of the 80s, everybody was too afraid to talk. You never had any human rights activists talking. And today, the youth speak openly now. They are very critical of the governments in Nigeria or Africa. But this is due to my father giving them this voice, this power of have no fear.
The film is Finding Fela, a two-hour documentary on the life, the music, the revolution, the work, and the faults of Fela Kuti. Femi Kuti, his son, musician in his own right, four-time Grammy-nominated musician, joins me here in studio. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Good to be here with you.
Thanks to Femi Kuti, and thanks to the Kuti family for all the great music you heard in our bumpers throughout the show. If you want to catch up on that conversation or listen back to anything, check us out at thetakeaway.org. Thank you again so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick, in for John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.